Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold, by Sterling Seagrave, narrated by David Colacci. Author's Note: Slaying the Messenger. Many people told us this book was historically important and must be published, then warned us that if it were published, we would be murdered. An Australian economist who read it said, "I hope they let you live." He did not have to explain who they were. Japan's looting of Asia and the hiding of this war gold in American banks is closely linked to the issue of Holocaust gold hidden in Swiss banks. Revealing the secrets of either is a dangerous business. Jean Ziegler, a Swiss professor and parliamentarian, did much to expose 5 decades of official amnesia in his book The Swiss, the Gold, and the Dead. After publishing it and testifying in 1998 before the U.S. Senate Banking Committee about Jewish assets in Swiss banks, he was charged with treason by Swiss federal prosecutor Carla Del Ponte. The charge was brought by 21 financiers, commercial lawyers, and politicians of the far right, many of them major stockholders in large Swiss banks. They accused Ziegler of being an accomplice of Jewish organizations who extorted vast sums of money from Switzerland. Ziegler is only one of many who have been persecuted for putting ethics before greed. Christoph Miley, a Union Bank Suisse, UBS, security guard, was threatened with murder and the kidnapping of his wife and children after he testified before a U.S. Senate committee about documents he rescued from UBS shredders. He and his family were given asylum in America. We have been threatened with murder before. When we published The Song Dynasty, we were warned by a senior CIA official that a hit team was being assembled in Taiwan to come murder us. He said, "I would take this very seriously if I were you." We vanished for a year to an island off the coast of British Columbia. While we were gone, a Taiwan hit team arrived in San Francisco and shot dead the Chinese-American journalist Henry Liu. When we published The Marcos Dynasty, we expected trouble from the Marcos family and its cronies, but instead we were harassed by Washington. Others had investigated Marcos, but we were the first to show how the U.S. government was secretly involved with Marcos gold deals. We came under attack from the U.S. Treasury Department and its Internal Revenue Service, whose agents made threatening midnight phone calls to our elderly parents. Arriving in New York for an author tour, one of us was intercepted at JFK Airport, passport seized, and held incommunicado for 3 hours. Eventually, the passport was returned without a word of explanation. When we ran Freedom of Information queries to see what was behind it, we were grudgingly sent a copy of a telex message on which every word was blacked out, including the date. The justification given for this censorship was the need to protect government sources, which are above the law. During one harassing phone call from a U.S. Treasury agent, he said he was sitting in his office watching an interview we had done for a Japanese TV network, an interview broadcast only in Japanese, which we had never seen. After publishing The Yamato Dynasty, which briefly mentioned the discovery that is the basis for Gold Warriors, our phones and email were tapped. We know this because when one of us was in a European clinic briefly for a medical procedure, the head nurse reported that someone posing as your American doctor had been on the phone asking questions. When a brief extract of this book was published in the South China Morning Post in August 2001, several phone calls from the editors were cut off suddenly. Emails from the newspaper took 72 hours to reach us, while copies sent to an associate nearby arrived instantly. In recent months, we began to receive veiled death threats. What have we done to provoke murder? To borrow a phrase from Jean Ziegler, we are combating official amnesia. We live in dangerous times, like Germany in the 1930s, when anyone who makes inconvenient disclosures about hidden assets can be branded a terrorist or a traitor. A few months ago, three ex-ambassadors to Japan declared that former American POWs and civilian slave laborers suing giant Japanese corporations for compensation were tantamount to terrorists. Now a CIA official says that leaks of classified information must be stopped, even if it is necessary to send SWAT teams into journalists' homes. Everybody's national security is a serious matter. We have no argument with that. But national security can be invoked to hide official corruption and conflict of interest. It's called tyranny. The only cure is openness and sunlight. In this book, we do not question whether President Truman did the right thing in keeping these war gold recoveries secret. That is for others to debate. What we point out is that total secrecy enabled corrupt people to abuse the resulting slush funds, and these abuses have multiplied like a cancer ever since. A global network of corruption has grown around the slush funds. Bureaucrats, politicians, spooks, and generals have become addicted to black money. There are indications that a lot of this war gold has been siphoned off by America's far right under the guise of patriotism. The unintended consequences of Truman's decision have become a poisonous part of the world financial system, putting innocent people at hazard. Those people and institutions benefiting from this corruption will do everything possible to hide it, including murder. The only way to get rid of an illness is first to recognize what it is. But when the emperor goes crazy from syphilis of the brain, the first person to be tortured and burned at the stake is the doctor who made the diagnosis, slaying the messenger. Despite the best efforts of the American and Japanese governments to destroy, withhold, or lose documentation related to Golden Lily, we have accumulated thousands of documents, conducted thousands of hours of interviews, and we make all of these available on two compact discs, available from our website, bowstring.net, so they can make up their own minds. We encourage others with knowledge of these events to come forward. When the top is corrupt, the truth will not come from the top. It will emerge in bits and pieces from people like John Ziegler and Christoph Miley, who decided they had to do something. As a precaution, should anything odd happen, we have arranged for this book and all its documentation to be put up on the Internet at a number of sites. If we are murdered, listeners will have no difficulty figuring out who they are. Money is the sinew of war. Cicero. The first casualty when war comes is truth. Senator Hiram Johnson, 1918. The study of money, above all other fields in economics, is one in which complexity is used to disguise truth or to evade truth, not to reveal it. John Kenneth Galbraith. Prologue. Buried Alive. In the closing months of World War II in the Philippines, while General Yamashita Tomoyuki fought a delaying action in the rugged mountains of Luzon, several of Japan's highest-ranking imperial princes were preparing for the future. They were busy hiding tons of looted gold bullion and other stolen treasure in nearby caves and tunnels to be recovered later. This was the property of 12 Asian countries, accumulated over thousands of years. Expert teams accompanying Japan's armed forces had systematically emptied treasures, banks, factories, private homes, pawn shops, art galleries, and stripped ordinary people, while Japan's top gangsters looted Asia's underworld and black economy. In this, the Japanese were far more thorough than the Nazis. It was as if a giant vacuum cleaner passed over East and Southeast Asia. Much of the plunder reached Japan overland through Korea. The rest, moving by sea, got no farther than the Philippines, as the U.S. submarine blockade became complete in early 1943. Hiding the treasure there was crucial, so that if Japan lost the war militarily, it would not lose financially. In whatever settlement concluded the war, Japan always expected to keep the Philippines. Overseen by the princes, 175 imperial treasure vaults were constructed throughout the islands. Early in June 1945, when U.S. tanks were less than 20 miles from Bambang, the 175 chief engineers of those vaults were given a farewell party 220 feet underground in a complex known as Tunnel 8, stacked wall to wall with row after row of gold bars. As the evening progressed, they drank great quantities of sake, sang patriotic songs, and shouted Banzai, long life, over and over. At midnight, General Yamashita and the princes slipped out, and dynamite charges were set off in the access tunnels, entombing the engineers. They were buried alive. Those who did not kill themselves ritually would gradually suffocate, surrounded by gold bars. The vaults would remain secret. In subsequent days, the princes escaped to Japan by submarine, and 3 months later, General Yamashita surrendered to American troops. For half a century, this grisly live burial remained unknown. The hidden treasure was brushed off as the legend of Yamashita's gold. But an eyewitness to the entombment has taken us to Tunnel 8 and given us his personal account. During the war, Ben Valmores was the young Filipino valet of an exceptional Japanese prince who was in charge of building, inventorying, and sealing all imperial treasure sites in the Philippines. Highly educated and sometimes sentimental, the prince spared Ben's life at the last moment and led him out of Tunnel 8 just before the dynamite was detonated. Ben, in poor health in his mid-70s when we interviewed him, told us over many months what he saw and experienced in the company of his prince from 1943 to 1945. He provided us with essential clues that eventually enabled us to identify his prince and most of the other princes involved. Japan's looting of Asia was overseen by Emperor Hirohito's charming and cultivated brother, Prince Chichibu. His organization was codenamed Kin no Yuri, Golden Lily, the title of one of the emperor's poems. Lesser princes headed different branches of Golden Lily across the conquered territories. Japanese sources now have confirmed that Ben's wartime master was Prince Takeda Tsuneyoshi, first cousin of Emperor Hirohito and a grandson of Emperor Meiji. To corroborate this, in 1998 we gave Ben a blind test with obscure 1930s photographs of many princes, photos that we obtained from the British Library Oriental Collection. These were photos of the princes in army uniform as they looked on the eve of Pearl Harbor. Although we removed the names from each photo and mingled photographs of ordinary soldiers, Ben instantly identified Prince Takeda, Hirohito's two brothers, Prince Chichibu and Prince Mikasa, and the elder Prince Asaka, who had commanded Japanese armies at the Rape of Nanking. Ben said he had spent time with each of them, bringing them food, tea, and cigarettes while they inventoried and closed treasure sites. Ben Valmores was a rural rice farmer who never left the Philippines and never went beyond grade school, so his instant correct identification of the princes was persuasive. When he came upon our photo of Prince Takeda, Ben froze, then began crooning the Japanese folk song Sakura Sakura, Cherry Blossoms, which he said Takeda often sang to himself. The discovery of Prince Takeda's identity provided us with a piece missing from a much larger puzzle. While we were writing a biography of Japan's imperial family, the Yamato Dynasty, we were told that in October 1945, American intelligence agents learned the location of some Japanese treasure vaults in the Philippines and secretly recovered billions of dollars worth of gold, platinum, cultural artifacts, and loose gems. This information, if true, revealed the existence of an extraordinary state secret that the U.S. government had kept hidden for over half a century. So serious were the implications that we decided they merited separate investigation. Here is some of what we have learned. On September 2, 1945, after receiving official notice of Japan's surrender, General Yamashita and his staff emerged from their mountain stronghold in the Kyangan Pocket and presented their swords to a group of U.S. Army officers led by Military Police Major A.S. Jack Kenworthy, who took them to New Bilibid Prison outside Manila. Because of gruesome atrocities committed earlier by Admiral Iwabuchi Kanji's sailors and Marines in the city of Manila, after Yamashita had ordered them to leave the city unharmed, the general was charged with war crimes. During his trial, there was no mention of war loot. But there was a hidden agenda. Because it was not possible to torture General Yamashita physically without this becoming evident to his defense attorneys, members of his staff were tortured instead. His driver, Major Kojima Kashii, was given special attention. Since Yamashita had arrived from Manchuria in October 1945 to take over the defense of the Philippines, Kojima had driven him everywhere. In charge of Kojima's torture was a Filipino-American intelligence officer named Severino Garcia Diaz Santa Romana, a man of many names and personalities, whose friends called him Santi. He wanted Major Kojima to reveal each place to which he had taken Yamashita, where bullion and other treasure were hidden. Supervising Santi, we learned, was Captain Edward G. Lansdale, later one of America's best-known Cold Warriors. In September 1945, Lansdale was 37 years old and utterly insignificant, only an advertising agency copywriter who had spent the war in San Francisco writing propaganda for the OSS. In September 1945, chance entered Lansdale's life in a big way when President Truman ordered the OSS to close down. To preserve America's intelligence assets and his own personal network, OSS Chief General William Donovan moved personnel to other government or military posts. Captain Lansdale was one of 50 office staff given a chance to transfer to U.S. Army G2 in the Philippines. There, Lansdale heard about Santi torturing General Yamashita's driver and joined the torture sessions as an observer and participant. Early that October, Major Kojima broke down and led Lansdale and Santi to more than a dozen Golden Lily treasure vaults in the mountains north of Manila, including two that were easily opened. What lay inside astounded everyone. While Santi and his team set to opening the rest of the vaults, Captain Lansdale flew to Tokyo to brief General MacArthur, then on to Washington to brief President Truman. After discussions with his cabinet, Truman decided to proceed with the recovery, but to keep it a state secret. The treasure, gold, platinum, and barrels of loose gems, was combined with Axis loot recovered in Europe to create a worldwide covert political action fund to fight communism. This black gold gave the Truman administration access to virtually limitless, unvouchered funds for covert operations. It also provided an asset base that was used by Washington to reinforce the treasuries of its allies, to bribe political leaders, and to manipulate elections in foreign countries. In the late 1940s, this agenda was seen as entirely justified, because the Soviet Union was aggressively supporting communist and socialist movements all over the world, putting the survival of the capitalist world in peril. Most will be as surprised as we were by this information. Some may be deeply troubled by Truman's strategic decision, which others may heartily endorse. It is not within the scope of this book to examine that decision or to explore whether it was right or wrong. It might have been a wise decision at the time, which had tragic consequences in the longer term. Ours is only a preliminary report, and in what follows we try to remain politically neutral. The only purpose of this book is to lift the veil of secrecy and to bring forward and examine the unforeseen consequences, which are many and troubling. It was not Truman's decision alone. The idea for a global political action fund based on war loot actually originated during the Roosevelt administration with Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson. During the war, Stimson had a brain trust, thinking hard about Axis plunder and how it should be handled when peace came. As the tide turned against the Axis, it was only a matter of time before treasure began to be recovered. Much of this war prize was in the form of gold looted by the Nazis from conquered countries and civilian victims. To eliminate any trace of original ownership, the Nazis had it melted down and recast as ingots hallmarked with the swastika and black eagle of the Reichsbank. There were other reasons why the gold was difficult to trace. Many of the original owners had died, and pre-war governments had ceased to exist. Eastern Europe was falling under the control of the Soviet Union, so returning gold looted there was out of the question. Stimson's special assistants on this topic were his deputies John J. McCloy and Robert Lovett, and consultant Robert B. Anderson, all clever men with outstanding careers in public service and banking. McCloy later became head of the World Bank, Lovett, Secretary of Defense, Anderson, Secretary of the Treasury. Their solution was to set up what is informally called the Black Eagle Trust. The idea was first discussed with America's allies in secret during July 1944, when 44 nations met at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, to plan the post-war world economy. This was confirmed, in documents we obtained, by a number of high-level sources, including a CIA officer based in Manila and former CIA Deputy Director Ray Klein, who knew of Santee's recoveries in 1945. As recently as the 1990s, Klein continued to be involved in attempts to control Japanese war gold still in the vaults of Citibank. After briefing President Truman and others in Washington, including McCloy, Lovett, and Stimson, Captain Lansdale returned to Tokyo in November 1945 with Robert B. Anderson. General MacArthur then accompanied Anderson and Lansdale on a covert flight to Manila, where they set out for a tour of the vaults Santee already had opened. In them, we were told, Anderson and MacArthur strolled down row after row of gold bars stacked 2 meters tall. From what they saw, it was evident that over a period of years Japan had looted many billions of dollars in treasure from all over Asia. What was seen by Anderson and MacArthur was only the gold that had not reached Japan. Far from being bankrupted by the war, Japan had been greatly enriched. According to Ray Klein and others, between 1945 and 1947, the gold bullion recovered by Santee and Lansdale was discreetly moved by ship to 176 accounts at banks in 42 countries. Secrecy was vital. If the recovery of a huge mass of stolen gold became known, thousands of people would come forward to claim it, many of them fraudulently, and governments would be bogged down resolving ownership. Truman also was told that the very existence of so much black gold, if it became public knowledge, would cause the fixed price of $35 an ounce to collapse. So many countries had linked their currencies to the U.S. dollar, and the dollar linked to gold, that currency values throughout the world would plummet, causing financial disaster. This argument may have been greatly exaggerated by those who stood to benefit from the Black Eagle strategy, but nobody could be certain what the consequences would be. If the gold was kept secret, prices could be kept at $35 an ounce, the dollar would remain strong, and currencies pegged to gold would be stable. Meanwhile, the black gold would serve as a reserve asset, bolstering the prime banks of allied countries, strengthening the governments of those nations. As a safeguard, the bullion placed in those banks was carefully controlled. Strict limits were placed on the use that could be made of the gold, a process called earmarking. This enabled Washington to bring pressure from time to time on those governments, central banks, and prime banks. Put simply, so long as a country and its leaders cooperated and remained allied to the United States in the Cold War, derivatives of the sleeping bullion could be used for patronage through political slush funds. Documents do show that between 1945 and 1947, very large quantities of gold and platinum were deposited in the world's biggest banks, including Union Banque Suisse and other Swiss banks, which became major repositories of the Black Eagle Trust. Swiss banks played a pivotal role because Switzerland had remained neutral during the war and its banks had not been looted, damaged, or depleted. Documents signed by senior Swiss banking officials show that very large loans backed by this asset base were then extended to the British government, the Egyptian government, the Chinese nationalist regime, and other governments struggling to recover from the war. What went wrong in the longer term is that the cloak of national security created a situation ripe for abuse. What protects national secrets also protects government officials and their collaborators in the private sector. In later chapters, we see numerous documented instances when these underground funds surfaced as huge bribes or were used to buy elections in Italy, Greece, Japan, and elsewhere. Beneficial trusts were set up in behalf of influential people throughout the world. Gold bearer certificates were given as inducements. In the hands of clever men, the possibilities were endless. Over a period of decades, some of the world's biggest banks became addicted to playing with the black gold in their vaults. Now they will do whatever is necessary to keep the gold, even if it means defrauding account holders or their heirs, as happened with Holocaust gold in Swiss banks. In retrospect, recovering Golden Lily treasure vaults and setting up the Black Eagle Trust were the easy parts, done for patriotic reasons and a noble cause. Making intelligent use of so much underground money during the Cold War was not so easy, when national security made peer review impossible. Who is to supervise clandestine funds, except those who benefit by using them? There were other abuses as well. To hide the existence of this treasure and to secure America's position against the tide of communism sweeping across Asia in the late 1940s, Washington told a number of major diplomatic lies, especially lies about Japan, which had stolen most of the gold. Japan's ruling elite were traditional hardcore conservatives, greatly alarmed by communism. America wanted Japan to be its anti-communist bastion in Asia, so the source of Tokyo's hidden wealth must never be acknowledged. The most ardent anti-communists in Tokyo happened to be indicted war criminals. So while America introduced democratic reforms and a new constitution, it put Japan back under the control of men who were devoutly undemocratic and kept them in power with huge infusions of black money. Washington insisted, starting in 1945, that Japan never stole anything and was flat, broke, and bankrupt when the war ended. Here was the beginning of many great distortions, which would become terrible secrets.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?